Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On November 30th, 2020, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Trump v. New York. The first legal question before the court was whether a group of states and local governments had standing under Article 3 of the Constitution to challenge a July 21st, 2020 memorandum by President Donald Trump instructing the Secretary of Commerce to include in his report on the 2020 census information enabling the president to exclude non-citizens from the base population number for purposes of apportioning seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. The second legal question before the court was whether the memorandum is a permissible exercise of the president's discretion under the provision of law governing congressional apportionment. Professor John S. Baker joins us today to discuss this case's oral argument. Professor Baker is professor emeritus at Louisiana State University's Paul H. Hebert Law Center.
I just looked at an email I got from The Hill, and the title of it is, or the headline is, "Conservative Justices Signal Willingness to Let Trump Proceed with Immigrant Census Plan for Now." I hope that what I am able to offer you is a little more insightful than that whole article that follows. In any event, it was an interesting, and as Justice Alito said, frustrating time this morning. In this argument, the argument ran 80 minutes, which is longer than usual, and it concerns the president's executive order back in July that he wanted from the Department of Commerce and specifically the Census Bureau a list or numbers related to the number of illegal aliens in the country to the extent that this was feasible and consistent with law. So immediately litigation followed from that. The way I would summarize the argument this morning is that it focused more on the justiciability question than it did on the merits. And that really is the basis for, I think, what the headline in The Hill was. But it wasn't just, quote, the so-called six, the conservatives. I mean, this was a real conundrum for all of them, and there was a lot of follow-up from one justice to another, regardless of ideology, because simply getting to the nub of the problem is difficult, and that's why so much of the time was spent on the justiciability question. The question of the president's power to do what he wants to do was touched on, and I think and wished it had been touched on more in one sense. But as I go along, I think I'll be able to show you that that is a minefield yet. So just a little background on what happened. So I mentioned the executive order by the president in July, exactly July 21st. Well, on July 24th, only 3 days later, this suit was filed. And this wasn't a single plaintiff. There were multiple states and nonprofits involved. They must have had most of their complaint already written even before the EO was published. Maybe they got some kind of a leak from somewhere that it was coming, because I don't know how they would have been able to put all this together that quickly, but they did. So they invoked a three-judge court pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 2244. For those of you old enough to remember, three-judge courts used to be quite common on constitutional issues, but Congress reformed that really at the behest of the federal judiciary, because three-judge courts get an automatic appeal to the Supreme Court. But in election matters, obviously, they're very timely, and so it is appropriate that there be a speedy appeal to the Supreme Court, or at least a speedy, if there is a right of appeal as opposed to certiorari, and there is on three-judge courts. So on September 10th, the three-judge court in New York issued a judgment, a declaratory judgment, and an injunction, a permanent injunction, in favor of the plaintiffs and against the government. On the justiciability issue, at that level, it was primarily a standing question. And the three-judge panel found that, quote, President Trump's memo had, quote, a chilling effect on participation in the census. Now, this is going to be important because the justiciability issues are slightly different when they get up on appeal. Anyway, the court thought that the fear that illegal immigrants would have caused by what President Trump was doing was such that they wouldn't participate in the census. Or if they weren't fearful, they figured that there'd be no point in participating. So either way, the states were going to suffer some kind of an injury. And of course, the second point on standing is caused by the defendant. Well, of course, President Trump caused all this fear. And third, redressability. Well, the redressability was, they said, that their order would be sufficient to block the harm. In any event, on the merits, they found that the president's proposal of eliminating illegal immigrants violated the language that is common to the Reapportionment Act, the 14th Amendment, and Article 1, the original section dealing with apportionment. And they rested this on not only the statutory, but the constitutional language about persons. And it's important to come back to that later. The declaratory judgment went into effect. The permanent injunction was applicable to everyone except the president. Now, that issue got a lot of some attention in the argument, and the question was in part whether, even though the president wasn't enjoined, would he respect and follow the declaratory judgment? Anyway, this is a complex case, and it was fully reflected in the argument. Now, as indicated by the introduction, I have very different, very definite viewpoints about these issues, so this is not going to be a completely detached explanation. But to some extent, we have to go over certain basics. And that is, on the merits, that question does not receive, as I said, as much attention as does the justiciability question. And for reasons that I'll explain, that may be good or it may be bad from my point of view and those who think that what the president did was perfectly defensible. Indeed, I go much further and say that his orders should exclude all foreign nationals. The SG, acting SG Jeffrey Wall, he did a very good job in oral argument, I thought. He knew everything. He had good answers to everything. And fortunately, from my point of view, he didn't get much into the merits, and that's why he had a good argument. Interestingly, he kept saying that he wouldn't be at all, you know, disturbed if the court decided to get to the merits. He wanted them to get to the merits. I think that was a big mistake, and I'm hopeful that they don't get to the merits. So let's go to the issues. First of all, as I said, justiciability. We have a new issue up here, and that is mootness, because the government is arguing rightly that the chilling effect no longer exists because the count in the field is over. And so whatever chill there was in the past, the weather has changed now. There's no more chilling effect. So then it came to the issue of standing. Now, most of what they are arguing in terms of the plaintiffs below is about what might happen, because nobody knows exactly. And that's for two reasons. One, the numbers are not yet available. That is, there's an involved process that we'll talk about a little bit as we go along, but they're not available. So we don't know at this point what the effect is going to be. And probably more importantly, there's no real way of knowing what the president's going to do. As everybody knows, he's rather unpredictable. So the argument on standing is there is no determination or ability to determine the harm, because at this point it is much too speculative. Now, interestingly, in this discussion, there were several references to a D.C. Circuit three-judge court opinion written by Judge Katsas just at the end of last week. And his opinion is, as always, extremely thorough. And he came down on the issue of rightness, not standing, but prudential rightness in the context of the non-Article III. He didn't reach the Article III issue of standing. He went into rightness. And Judge Kavanaugh at one point went through an interesting discussion about the overlap between standing and rightness and distinguishing prudential rightness from other Article III issues. Only a federal courts person or somebody who's litigating this stuff all the time would really have a great deal of interest in that. But in any event, it was an important consideration as to whether they really ought to get into the merits of this thing, given so many uncertainties. And the certainties are going to, in large part, have to do with the number. So related to the justiciability issue is obviously timing. Timing. So what is the timing? By the end of the year, the Census Bureau is supposed to send to the president their numbers, what they've come up with. And the question comes down to, in a way, well, are there two sets of numbers? And what is the meaning of the census? And as the government brief pointed out several times, the word census is used in two different contexts. That is, census means gathering the numbers, and then census means the final numbers that are produced. The question involves the process that the Census Bureau itself goes through and hands off to the Secretary of Commerce, and then is relayed to the president. And then by the 10th of January, the president must send to the Congress a statement showing, one, the population base, and two, the apportionment for each state, the number of seats in the House of Representatives that they have. Now, it's really around this point that many of the justices are really somewhat, shall we say, uncertain, and there's a good deal of concern, I guess, about what it is they know and when they will know. So Justice Alito put it this way. He said, the posture of the case is quite frustrating, meaning, as he went on to discuss, are we talking about a relatively small number, or are we talking about a very large number? And other justices picked up on this also. And Wall repeatedly said he can't say how many they will be able to match from the administrative records. Now, let me talk a little bit about what he's referring to, the administrative records. The administrative records have been used to adjust the numbers. So the one that I'm most familiar with involves college students. In the last census, I got a call from the Census Bureau saying, we see you have students in college. Are they in your state where you live, or are they in a different state? And I said, no, they're in a different state. Well, they didn't tell me, but I knew what they were doing. What they were doing is they were going to deduct the my children who are domiciled where I live, but who were attending school out of state. The Census Bureau has made the determination wrong, I think, that they will be counted in other states. This is part of the adjustment process that the Census Bureau does. And this process, often using administrative records, has been used for a long time, and the court in a previous case has approved it. So that's what's going on in part. Now, this gets complicated because when the president issued his executive order back after the citizenship case decision, he noted that at that point they had 90% of the administrative records already available to the Census Bureau. And that was due to the fact that the Commerce Department and the Census Bureau had been collecting some for a long time anyway. But the places that they didn't really have enough information were the State Department and especially the Department of Homeland Security. So the issue really was, well, what's involved? If you got these administrative records and you had them a year ago for 90%, shouldn't you have 100% by now? And what's involved in the matching process? There was an attempt by S.G. Wall to explain that, but it was never fully understood, I don't think, by any of the justices. And they were continued to say they didn't know how many matches they would be able to make, even though they were working as hard as they could to determine this. Now, the impact of that is that if the numbers are relatively small and we're not talking about a great deal that would shift a representative from one state to another, that's one thing. But as Justice Sotomayor pointed out, you know, you should know this by now if you've been working on this for over a year, and you say that you're going to eliminate as many as feasible and consistent with the law. And if that's a large number, it could have a huge impact. Now, that affects the justiciability question. How is that going to disrupt the whole process of redistricting? And is that a matter that can be dealt with adequately after the president sends the apportionment numbers to the Congress by January 10th? Is there going to be enough time? There was a great deal of concern about this and no clear resolution. And Wall honestly couldn't give them a resolution of it. So does that make a difference? Well, Justice Kagan thought that it was possible we're talking about 4 to 5 million people that might be in some way affected. But again, that seems to be a heavy consideration on all the justices. And then, as I mentioned, it's not clear what the president would do. In the argument made by the Solicitor General in the written briefs, I was very critical of in my SCOTUS piece, because he claims that the president has the discretion to eliminate illegal aliens, to do so selectively, and no obligation to do so. I mean, there's no standard to that. And on what basis are you saying you can do some but not all? And that didn't come up really in the oral argument. The Solicitor General was focusing on certain defined categories, notably at least some, he said at one point, at least. And he mentioned several times those who are being detained and are about to be deported. Now, this is where I don't think the argument in the brief is strong enough, because it doesn't really make a constitutional argument. And the problem with that is that the ACLU in particular, better than the New York Solicitor General, they are arguing that from the beginning, this is only about where you reside. And they're equating residing with inhabitant. Now, the government brief says, well, it's not just residing. You have to have a connection to the place. The issue, however, is they did not really ever make a constitutional argument that was clear at all. And by the way, this whole situation, and it couldn't be said, the mess that's been created is due directly to the fact that the Supreme Court decided, as it did in Department of Commerce versus New York last year, when it said the citizenship question could not be put on the census. That's why they switched to the administrative records. In some ways, the administrative records may be more accurate, but if you don't have all the information you need in the administrative records, how are you going to allocate and eliminate certain people, but not other people, because you don't have sufficient information? That is the core of the problem. And the reason I think, as I think the Hill was indicating, that it is likely that the case will be dismissed on justiciability grounds is a great amount of uncertainty at this point. Now, I want to go to the merits question, which was only briefly talked about. And that is, the merits question on the first go-around was only raised by Judge Barrett. And this is where I think the government may have trouble. I mean, we know that she is a textualist and an originalist. And they have not made in their brief, and they did not make in their argument, the kind of argument that a textualist and an originalist would need to go with their argument. When you first read the language of Article 1 and the 14th Amendment and the Reapportionment Act, you may think, as I did until about 11 years ago, that of course everybody has to be counted. But when you go back and look at the drafts of the Constitution and the use of the word inhabitant in those drafts up till the final draft, and the final form was not to change any substance of what the members of the convention had agreed to. And the Supreme Court has recognized this. And for the government merely to rest primarily on a statutory argument in the case of Franklin, it seems to me, is a weakened argument, at least for originalists. If we get a decision on the merits without adequate explanation of the constitutional argument, I'm not hopeful about what the decision on the merits might look like.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.